This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden gained 87 votes in the state of Wisconsin as a partial recount of ballots was completed Sunday. This cemented his 20,000-vote victory over President Donald Trump in the Midwestern state as a recount of the November 3rd presidential election concluded there. The Trump campaign paid $3 million for the recount of the 800,000 votes in the two most heavily Democratic areas of the state in hopes of upending Biden's claim to the state's 10 electoral college votes. Instead, however, Wisconsin became the latest state where Mr. Trump, a Republican, has failed in recounts to overturn the November 3rd vote or win lawsuits alleging that voter fraud cost him a second four-year term in the White House. Mr. Biden is set to be inaugurated as the country's 46th president on January 20th. At 78 years old, he will be its oldest leader so far. Last week, he named his first cabinet nominees and plans to announce the names of key economic officials this week. Aid groups say hospitals in the capital of Ethiopia's Tigray region are facing an influx of trauma patients a day after federal troops claimed control of the city, and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said fighting was over. Last year's Nobel Peace Prize winner Abiy declared victory on Saturday evening in a three-week military confrontation with leaders of Tigray's ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. But a communications blackout in Tigray has made it impossible to independently verify whether the regional assault is completely under the region is completely under federal government control. On Sunday, the International Committee of the Red Cross said health workers are struggling with shortages of food and medical supplies. VOA News. Data from Johns Hopkins University shows U.S. COVID-19 cases have swollen to more than 13 million, with more than 266,000 Americans having died of infections, and the nation's top infectious disease expert saying it's not getting better anytime soon. Dr. Anthony Fauci, speaking to ABC's This Week show on Sunday, said, quote, help is on the way. He added that the initial supply of vaccines might be available by mid-December. Fauci said health experts are empathetic about the fatigue of Americans who have been careful about becoming exposed to the virus, but he said wearing face masks and people physically distancing themselves from others do make a difference. Millions of Americans curtailed their traditional family gatherings for Thursday's annual Thanksgiving holiday. Millions of others, however, ignored warnings from healthcare experts against traveling to visit far-flung relatives for fear of spreading the virus. White House senior advisor Jared Kushner and his team are heading to Saudi Arabia and Qatar this week for talks in a region simmering with tension after the killing of an Iranian nuclear scientist. A senior administration official said on Sunday that Kushner is to meet Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the Emir of Qatar in that country in the coming days. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has vowed to avenge the assassination of that top nuclear scientist in Iran. He and other Iranian officials are blaming the killing on Israel, but some diplomats and analysts say they don't expect Iran to retaliate quickly for the meticulously planned shooting. This scientist was the second senior Iranian military figure to be assassinated this year. Analysts believe Iran will bide its time before responding rather than provoke a fierce military response from outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump. A mysterious shiny monolith that was spotted in a remote southeastern Utah desert 2 weeks ago has vanished. The structure was first spotted by a crew of state workers counting bighorn sheep from a helicopter. The discovery sparked international speculation about the origin and purpose of the object, which was about twice as tall as the average adult human being. The location of the monolith was not made public, but it still drew dozens of onlookers who found their way to the mysterious object. The State Bureau of Land Management on Saturday said the monolith had disappeared. People in the art world have speculated that the object was a work of artist John McCracken, a sculptor who died in 2011. His son told the New York Times his father had hoped to leave his artwork in remote places to be discovered later. You can find more on this and other stories at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, and from Washington, you're listening to VOA News.
Today Break Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, November 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ethiopia says its military operation in the Tigray region is over.
The fact that they control the city and that the military engagement is over doesn't mean that there will be sporadic, because some of the members of the special force of the TPLF may operate, I think, more like a guerrilla warfare.
An analyst cautions SADC against military intervention in Mozambique. The people of Nigeria's Borno State are burying those killed by Boko Haram insurgents. Uganda's Bobi Wine accuses President Museveni of violence against opposition, but President Museveni says no one is above the law.
The idea that Honorable Kyagulanyi or any politician is untouchable because he's a politician, and if police legitimately arrest him, there will be riots, is not acceptable and must never be repeated.
And tomorrow's World AIDS Day, and the United Nations calls on governments to put the most vulnerable at the center of their AIDS and COVID-19 responses. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An Ethiopian analyst says he hopes Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed will be able to forge a smooth relationship with the people of Tigray. The comments came as Prime Minister Ahmed announced Saturday that the military operation was over and that the federal troops had taken control of the region's capital. But the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, said on Sunday that it had retaken a town from federal forces. There was no immediate confirmation of the claim. Dr. Masembet Asefa, assistant professor of law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law, says the capture of the regional capital Mekelle may not mean the end of the conflict, because some TPLF special forces have indicated that they will resort to guerrilla warfare.
I think the sense I have is that, you know, of course, the control of Mekelle, the fact that the military controlled the city, came as a surprise for many of us, because we thought it would take them some days. Because for anyone who knows the city of Mekelle, it's a very big city with a residence of 500,000 people. So the understanding is that it would take some time, but it seems that they have advanced very well. The fact that they've controlled the city and that the military engagement is over doesn't mean that they're willing to be sporadic, because some of the members of the special force of the TPLF may operate, I think, more like a guerrilla warfare.
That is very concerning.
For me, I wouldn't be much concerned, because it's just, James, as you know, liberation fronts are the history of the past in Africa for most of the, I think, political context currently in Africa. So the understanding is that because that they have that experience for about 70 years during the 1970s and 80s, they can do it now. But it's completely, I think, the political context, the diplomatic context, and the context of the country currently in Ethiopia is quite different.
Professor, this military operation, was it really against the TPLF or the Tigrayan people?
Absolutely against TPLF. Because, of course, we have to understand that the party, because of its historical relationship with the people of Tigray, galvanizing the people's support in toppling the Berg, was evident. But now, the context is very different. And clearly, as the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed outlined, this was a very targeted military engagement to topple the inner core of the TPLF. So the goal was exactly to, I think in the long term, the government would be able to, of course, create a kind of smooth relationship with the people of Tigray and the recently established Prosperity Party of Tigray, which aligns with Prime Minister's party. There are very, I think, visionary and good leaders that I have at least personally looked.
So what do you think, with the end of the military operation, what's next for Ethiopia or the Abe government? I mean, he has to bring the country together.
For me, I think this, for many people, they don't seem to understand there is also an ideological line about this war. Because for Ethiopia, the political experiment, as you know, constitutional experiment, you know, any constitutional exercise is a political experiment. So you always assess the conditions, the context, the political economy of the country, and try to reshape the discourse as you go ahead. You know, unity, common understanding, and, you know, kind of a collective vision of a political society like Ethiopia is significant. Abiy Ahmed is a very difficult man. He may question some of his tactics, but in terms of projecting this political tie in the next decade, for me, we have a very good possibility. That period is going to be, of course, difficult, but I think he has a very correct perspective in terms of projecting this political tie in the next decade.
Dr. Masembet Atsefa is the Assistant Professor of Law at the Addis Ababa University School of Law. An analyst says he doesn't think that leaders of the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC, should send their armies to quell the Islamic militant insurgency in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province because the region does not have a capable military intervention infrastructure. Rejoice Mgwenya of Zimbabwe also says he doesn't think the Mozambican government has done enough to resolve the issue politically. At their meeting last Friday in Botswana, SADC Troika leaders agree on finalizing a comprehensive regional response and support to Mozambique.
First of all, this is a case of a deja vu, James, because the last time that we heard about SADC intervening, it was in the DRC, and it turned out to be Zimbabwe versus Uganda and Rwanda. And eventually it drove our country into intractable debt. So we are going back to the same situation where we are being dragged into an internal crisis that requires a political solution. Most analysts, including myself, James, I am not satisfied that the Mozambican government has taken enough effort to seek a political solution. Point number two, I do not think that the organ on politics and security is a capable military interventionist infrastructure. This is all a pie in the air. You know, these countries need more preparation. And secondly, I think it's better to capacitate the Mozambican government and army in terms of managing the crisis internally.
It seems to me you are saying, Rejoice, that perhaps SADC may not have a standing military force or a mechanism to deal with such a situation. Can they depend on South Africa with its strong military?
You see, the South African situation is a bit different because there are certain democratic principles that reign supreme. Staff. There is absolutely no way Cyril Ramaphosa can commit the South African Defense Force to a SADC military excursion without consulting the South African Parliament. It's going to be a big problem because already the SADC countries are struggling under the COVID-related indebtedness. So if SADC is going to commit itself and hope that South Africa is going to... because in the first place, I don't think any South African interests are under challenge, although we are told that these dissidents are causing a security issue in SADC. You know, the trade routes of South Africa are not challenged. You know, the tourism, the Green Belt is not challenged. So I'm not sure whether SADC has done enough analysis to see to what extent South Africa is going to intervene. I think, you know, our presidents need to do more research and analysis.
But you would agree, Rejoice, that the insurgency in Mozambique, if not dealt with, poses a serious threat to the SADC region, eh?
Well, it's true that, you know, generally such insurgencies, especially if they have, you know, leanings of you know, extreme fundamentalism, might cascade out of proportion. But I still insist, James, that I believe that is a political problem because Zimbabwe and Malawi and possibly Mozambique share borders with Mozambique, with Tanzania, with Mozambique. So it's likely that, you know, the border citizens of Zimbabwe are already battle weary and they have had experience and the Matanga experience of these cross-border incursions. It will cause so much anxiety and destabilization. It's true, it might escalate into a regional issue, but for now, I think it can be able to be managed internally as long as the capacity of negotiation, political analysis and intervention of Mozambique is improved.
The president of Malawi, Lazarus Chakwera, he's to become the next chair of SADC. And he was saying on Friday about the forced intervention brigade of SADC, which is operating within MONUSCO, the United Nations Organization of Stabilization Force. That what ECOWAS or SADC could use.
Right. You know, he makes a very good point. He's talking about the command system that is run under the United Nations. And the assumption is that You know, when you are putting together such an intervention force under the United Nations, it's a kind of a global investment. You know, now I don't understand how SADC can be able to persuade MONUSCO to shift its emphasis to the SADC region without any investment on it. So again, it's on paper, it sounds very reasonable that they can deploy the same units that have experience in intervention in other countries. But I don't know whether the challenges and the problems are the same. The circumstances are different and the insurgency is different. So if it's going to be done, it must be given articulate planning, and there should be, you know, also social considerations on the impact it's going to have on our citizens across the borders.
Rejoice Mgwenya is a Zimbabwe political analyst who is speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has condemned politicians who, he says, violate government measures to curtail the spread of the COVID-19 pandemic. President Museveni says he will deal with any individuals that intends to destabilize the country. In a nationwide speech on Sunday, Mr. Museveni said no one, including Uganda's top opposition politician, Robert Chakulai, popularly known as Bobby Wine, is untouchable. Mugumi Davis Rakarinji reports from Kampala.
In his address to the nation about the state of security and elections in the country this Sunday evening, President Yoweri Museveni condemned the recent protests in which over 50 people were killed. He said the protests, which he termed as riots, were aimed at making the city unruly. In fact, Mr. Museveni said the protests were not justified.
If the Honorable Chagulanyi was arrested, his supporters should have waited for him to go to court, as he eventually did. The idea that Honorable Chagulanyi or any politician is untouchable because he's a politician, and if police legitimately arrest him, there will be riots, is not acceptable and must never be repeated.
The president said his government cannot look on as rioters take charge of looting and causing havoc in the city, including undressing women in the public.
The overall security posture of Uganda is robust. And that's why many people make a miscalculation, because they don't know actually our system. They just see a few policemen. They think that is the end of the story. A marked force response was immediately activated, and 1,014 suspects were arrested, of whom 843 suspects were charged in the courts of law, including Chagulanyi.
Chagulanyi, arguably the leading opposition leader in the country, was arrested on a campaign trail allegedly for breaking measures aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19. His arrest provoked protests by his supporters asking for his release. The president did not directly condemn the killings, but promised to investigate the police actions, including death by what he called stray bullets.
Unfortunately, 54 people died in this confusion. 32 of the dead were rioters. Some were hit by stray bullets, others, not the 32. Because the 32 died in confrontation with the police, they were attacking the police, and the police, the security forces, shot them because they were attacking them.
Without mentioning names, he said some opposition politicians conspire to destabilize the country.
Some of the political actors, working with anti-Ugandan elements from outside, have been promoting the impunity and swearing that they will render Uganda ungovernable. We have been monitoring them through intelligence. These groups, working with criminal gangs, whom they pay money and give drugs, taking advantage of serious weaknesses in the police, some areas of Kampala were declared no-go areas for law enforcement.
President Museveni said the government will compensate families whose people were innocently killed in the protests. The president did not give the timeline for the investigation, nor did he mention the compensation plan. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, said his movement is a people movement and it is not supported by foreigners. He made a comment Sunday night as he and President Yoweri Museveni made competing speeches to the nation. Bobi Wine, who delivered his speech on Facebook because he says the government would not grant him access to the public media, says his movement is supported by Ugandans from all walks of life.
And I must reassert this, that this is a homegrown cause. Ours is a Ugandan cause. Forget what President Museveni continues saying, that we are funded by foreigners. We are not funded by foreigners. We're not even funded. We're supported by Ugandans living here and abroad. And it's on this note that I want to thank the Ugandans in the diaspora. Thank you for believing in us. Thank you for taking the risk with us. We know fighting a dictatorship is a risk, but thank you for believing in us. We can only promise you our unrelenting commitment to this cause. We are definitely removing a dictator.
Addressing the nation Sunday night, President Museveni said 54 people died in what he called confusion and 32 of them were rioters. But Bobi Wine accused the president of being behind the violence.
I want to condemn in the strongest terms the violence. The violence that was unleashed by the regime. You see, the Museveni regime has always prided its violence. They even call themselves the masters of violence. And indeed, they try as much as possible to send so much fear in the hearts of the Ugandans. When they illegally arrested in Luoka, people protested. But as President Museveni said it recently when he was in Karamoja, Mr. Museveni, once again, you conceded to ordering the military to kill unarmed civilians, just like he conceded to the fact that he's the one that ordered for the murder of Yasin Kaoma and my own murder, only that God saved my life.
That was Ugandan opposition presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Monday, November 30th. The UN Program on HIV and AIDS says stigma and discrimination against marginalized populations are driving both the AIDS crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic and must be tackled and eliminated in what officials call the dual colliding pandemics. In a report released in advance of World AIDS Day on December 1st, the UN agency calls on government to put the most vulnerable at the center of their pandemic responses. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
It is nearly 40 years since HIV/AIDS emerged. While progress in the treatment of the disease has been made, AIDS remains a public health menace. Last year, UNAIDS reported 1.7 million people were infected with HIV and 690,000 died. Health officials report the global response to ending AIDS as a public health threat by 2030 was off track even before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. The rapid spread of coronavirus, they say, is creating additional setbacks. Part of UNAIDS' new strategy for tackling AIDS is to direct money to the people most at risk. Yet Minister for Foreign Trade and Development Cooperation in the Netherlands, Sigrid Kaag, says that is not happening. She notes a study commissioned by the Netherlands finds only 2% of AIDS funding worldwide targets those who are most at risk.
62% of new HIV infections are among gay men, sex workers, drug users, and transgender people. How can we end the HIV pandemic, or any pandemic for that matter, if we ignore those most at risk? Stigma and criminalization impede access to medical services. And this is exactly how pandemics continue to spread.
East and Southern Africa is the region most heavily affected by HIV. The region is home to nearly 21 million out of the 38 million people living with HIV worldwide. It notes 12 million are not receiving treatment for their illness. Yet even under these circumstances, countries such as Eswatini and Botswana in sub-Saharan Africa, Cambodia and Thailand in Asia have made remarkable progress in tackling the deadly disease by implementing people-centered policies. UNAIDS Executive Director Winnie Byanyima says governments must focus on helping the most vulnerable, marginalized people. She says they must target preventive measures, sexual, reproductive, and other health services toward them, and not just implement policies that are politically palatable.
We're going to have to be more focused, focusing on the hot spots, not choosing what we want to address because that's what we are comfortable with, but being evidence-based, targeting closely where the risk is, not where we don't want to see.
Byanyima says governments also must focus on reducing the inequalities that are the drivers of HIV and COVID-19. She says more investment must be made in strengthening health systems and providing treatment and care to all in need. She says respecting the human rights of people most at risk is crucial in beating back the twin pandemics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Champions League preliminary round matches, which got underway this past weekend. In Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, Nigeria club side Enyimba FC beat Rahimu 1-0 in the first leg of their CAF Champions League preliminary round match at the Stade de Four out on Sunday. In Jos, Nigeria's other representative in the competition, Plateau United, lost 1-0 to Tanzanian champions Simba FC. Simba's coach, Sylvain Vandenberg, described the match as a tough one.
A tough game. I must say the Nigerians played better than I expected. They have a lot of power and they were trying something tactical. What we adjust in halftime so we could break out a bit more in the second half, and it resulted in a goal.
Elsewhere in East Africa, Uganda's Viper Soccer Club on Saturday lost 1-0 to visiting Sudan's Al Hilal. Viper's coach Fred Kagoba, after the match, said his side failed to take their chances.
We got 3, 4, 5 clear chances. We didn't score. We played very good second half. I think we shall win anyway.
Rwandan giants APR FC will take a narrow lead against Kenyan champions Gor Mahia into the second leg of their CAF Champions League preliminary round qualifier after their 2-1 win in Kigali. Elsewhere, Firas Chouet scored a second-half hat-trick as Tunisian side CS Faxien sealed a 5-0 hammering of Zambian side Milandige. The game between Al-Hali Benghazi of Libya and Ethiopia's Mikele 70 and Dereta FC did not take place as Mikele failed to show up for the game. Staying with CAF Champions League, Mohamed Madgi Afshar scored a beauty of a goal with 4 minutes left on the clock as Al Ahly beat Zamalek 2-1 at the Cairo International Stadium on Friday to clinch a record-extending 9th total CAF Champions League title. The Cairo Derby, the first time a final was being decided by teams from the same country, looked to be headed for a draw before Magdi scored a beauty to hand the Red Devils the coveted piece of silverware. And for head coach Pitso Mosimane, who joined the team less than 3 months ago, this is his second Champions League title, coincidentally against the same club he beat to clinch his first crown in 2016 when he was at Mamelodi Sundowns. And now, on a rather sad note, it has been confirmed that former Fulham, Portsmouth, West Ham and Birmingham midfielder Papa Buba Diop has died aged 42. The defensive midfielder, nicknamed the Wardrobe, was one of Senegal's memorable 2002 World Cup run, including scoring the goal in the opening match that defeated holders France. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
And that's it for this Monday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butt in Washington, hoping that you will have a great week.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.